Welcome to Washington Today for Tuesday, September 14th, 2021. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba. Members of the House Ways and Means Committee continue debating the president's 2022 budget reconciliation bill. The focus of the $3.5 trillion bill today was on tax increases, as well as issues like prescription drug prices, climate, and green energy. We hear first from Committee Chair Massachusetts Democrat Richard Neal on what the bill aims to do.
We continue our markup of the Build Back Better Act after a truly historic 2 days last week. Last Thursday, this committee advanced investments to provide 12 weeks of paid leave and medical leave for all members of the American family. We took action on affordable child care, and we have expanded opportunities for workers to save financially for secure retirements. And on Friday, we approved funds to strengthen pro-worker trade programs, expand health care benefits in Medicare, grow our health care workforce, and protect America's elderly and people with disabilities in nursing homes. Millions of Americans' lives will change for the better thanks to these provisions. This week, we will build on that progress. The proposal we will consider over the next 2 days includes additional investments in the American family and the American economy. Emphasis on the term investment. We will invest in the development and deployment of clean energy, take bold steps in the fight against climate change, create good jobs, lower prescription drug costs, close the Medicaid coverage gap, enable greater infrastructure development, and broadly help Americans live healthier and more financially secure lives. We will do this while responsibly funding our investments. Those who, in the 2017 tax law, left behind also took the hardest financial hit during the COVID crisis. Meanwhile, the big and strong and the wealthiest Americans, who saw the most substantial benefits from the 2017 tax law, indeed fared much better. As the stock market rebounded quickly and soared to new heights, we saw again greater concentration of wealth. We all read the reports of widespread stock buybacks and CEO bonuses that occurred thanks to those changes in the tax code. Business didn't use their new savings to always lower consumer prices or raise workers' wages. Mega corporations didn't need that law to stay afloat. We celebrate success in this great nation that we all love. But we can also ask the biggest companies and the ultra-wealthy to contribute a bit more to the common good. That's why our proposal today asks those in this nation who are doing extremely well to pay a bit more to support the services and the infrastructure on which our society and often their business and investments rely.
That's House Ways and Means Committee Chair Massachusetts Democrat Representative Richard Neal. Meanwhile, Republicans say this bill is wasteful. The ranking member from Texas, Representative Kevin Brady, explains.
This is truly a historic day. Never has our government wasted so much to kill so many American jobs, drive prices even higher, and hook a whole new generation of the poor on government dependency. This is an economic surrender. China, Russia, Europe, and Japan are cheering. This is trillions of dollars of wasteful government spending to fuel inflation even further. This will raise taxes on the middle class and small business. This is easily the biggest economic blunder of our lifetime. Don't look for much common sense here. When prices are growing faster than paychecks each and every month President Biden's been in office, how does it make sense to heap on another $3.5 trillion in government spending that'll drive prices up higher and last longer? When businesses are fighting to recover from the COVID pandemic, how will raising their taxes help them get back on their feet and get Americans back to work? After the U.S. leapfrogged to the most competitive economy in the world following Republican tax reform, what are we thinking? Saddling America's businesses with higher tax rates than communist China and most of the world, especially when it guarantees U.S. jobs, research, manufacturing, investment are driven overseas. You remember, it happened all the time during the Obama-Biden White House. And who gets hurt most? Workers and communities pay the price when jobs move overseas and when businesses are forced to send their money to Washington to be wasted. rather than invested in their workers in their local communities? How does it make any sense to take more of what small businesses work so hard to earn, leaving them even less to spend on growing their business and hiring more? Why in heaven's names are Democrats exposing even more family-owned farms and businesses to the horrible death tax, forcing them to sell their land or business to pay the IRS rather than hand down their lifetime of work to the next generation? This hurts multi-generational farms and women in minority-owned businesses. Who thinks it makes sense to give up American sovereignty of our tax code so we look more like foreign countries, favoring foreign companies and workers over American ones? And make no mistake, the Biden tax bill raises taxes on the middle class. Just ask the Liberal Tax Policy Center, who states nearly three-fourths of middle-class tax workers will see higher taxes starting next year and up to 90% in the future. The Joint Committee on Taxation also agrees the lower and middle-class families bear a real burden of the corporate tax hike. It's disheartening with so many families struggling with devastating diseases like cancer, ALS, Alzheimer's, muscular dystrophy, and Parkinson's. How does it make any sense for Congress to risk stopping up to 100 life-saving cures for these diseases just so Democrats can pay for huge green welfare subsidies for the wealthy and big business? In this bill, Democrats dole out 5 times more in green welfare subsidy than America spends on basic medical research at the National Institutes of Health each year. Where in the world are their priorities?
Following the developments on this $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill is Fortune magazine's politics reporter, Nicole Goodkind. You are following what happened today with the House Ways and Means Committee. What did you see?
Yeah, so there was a markup meeting which allowed us to hear from many Republicans on these tax provisions for the first time since they were revealed yesterday, and they weren't very happy with them. In particular, they took issue with a provision that modifies a tax on private colleges' endowments. And then they also took another that allows for renewable energy tax incentives. Both were defeated. We see Democrats have the majority there. So it was a whole lot of nothing, but we did get to see a little bit of what their strategy will be going forward, which is really just saying that Democrats aren't looking out for Americans, middle-class Americans out there.
The headline at Fortune.com reads, Democrats float largest tax increase in decades to fund Biden's $3.5 trillion budget. As we talk with politics reporter Nicole Goodkind, please tell us, how do Democrats plan to accomplish that?
Right, so this is one of the largest tax increases we'll see in decades. This is more than $2 trillion, which never reads well on campaign ads against Democrats. So how are they going to actually sell this and get this through? That's what they're trying to figure out right now. They're doing it by branding it as this increase largely on wealthy individuals and profitable corporations, not on the middle class. And that's what they're trying to sell here. But here's what they actually plan on doing. So about $1 trillion, or roughly one-third of this funding, is going to come from high-income Americans. That means people who are making over $450,000. And they'll be taxed now at 39.6%, which is what the top rate was before President Donald Trump cut it to 37% in 2017. There's also going to be a capital gains tax that would go up to 25% from 20%. And perhaps the most progressive item here would be a 3% surtax applied to incomes over $5 million. So Democrats are selling this as something that is going to affect the ultra-wealthy and kind of redistribute that for this $3.5 trillion human infrastructure plan. Now, there's also going to be a corporate tax rate increase, and that's going to go up from 21% to 26.5%. And that's for businesses with incomes in excess of $5 million. So they're saying, well, keeping small businesses with incomes below $400,000 out of this, they're actually going to see their rates lower to 18%. So that's how they're going to attempt to sell it to Main Street America. But Republicans and business lobbying groups are not so happy with this. They have been outraged by the proposal, as one might expect. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce called it an existential threat to America's fragile economic recovery and future prosperity. So those are some tough words. We're going to see a large fight ahead of us.
And in your article, you write, major directive handed down from the White House, get infrastructure down and get it done quickly. So Democrats are branding this also as the human infrastructure bill. More on money for health care, education, family services and environmental programs and tax breaks for families. But with so much of it paid for with tax increases on the rich and corporations, as you said. So which specific sectors and industries are vulnerable to cuts under this bill?
Specifically, I mean, all large corporations, corporations bringing in more than $5 million will see pretty major increases in their tax rate. So that will be problematic for them. But there is one specific group. These businesses called pass-through entities. So those are law firms and financial companies that distribute their profits to their owners, who then pay individual income taxes on them, as opposed to actually paying the corporate rate. Those will see an extension of an existing 3.8% surtax, which will affect them. Foreign entities, corporations that operate overseas, will also see a pretty large increase on their corporate foreign earnings, which will affect them as well. But overall, we're going to see a lot of subsidies for green energy and R&D there. So those types of corporations will actually benefit from this.
Are Democrats getting any traction with calling this a human infrastructure bill and then seeing Republicans not jumping on board with it?
Yeah, I mean, we'll see them campaign on this, especially when it comes to the climate crisis and family leave. I think that they have some traction there. You know, these are real kitchen table issues that every American is feeling the urgency of right now. And that's certainly what they're going to campaign on. I think that they have something, especially with these tax increases on the ultra wealthy, right? They can say, look, the Republicans don't want you to have parental leave. They don't want your Medicare and Medicaid expansion. They don't want to save you from the flooding and extreme weather events that are roiling this country right now. Instead, they want to, you know, help out the individuals making over $5 million and large corporations. But something that's interesting is that House Democrats, we've seen a kind of waiver here. They're actually more mindful, I think, of moderate concerns in their party than of these progressive ambitions. So they focus on raising tax rates on income rather than including these more progressive measures that were actually proposed by the White House and some Senate Democrats to tax wealth or to close loopholes that allow these super rich people to pass on their lifetime of gains to their heirs tax-free. Those will actually remain in place. And, you know, we see Jeff Bezos, for example. You know, he only made a few hundred thousand dollars last year. Most of his income actually comes from these other entities, the stock shares he has, and those will largely remain the same. So I think that there are ways that Republicans can say that, you know, Democrats aren't actually doing what they say they're doing.
And to that point, Nicole Goodkind, politics reporter for Fortune magazine, this is a reconciliation bill, so it only needs a majority of the Senate to pass. But what chance do political prognosticators give this bill of succeeding?
Well, yeah, so this has to pass along party lines. I don't think there's any way a Republican is going to vote for it in the Senate. And Democrats have two problems, and their names are Manchin and Sinema. So that's Senator Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona and West Virginia. These are the more moderate Democrats who are holding up the bill. They say $3.5 trillion is too much. They're unsure, and they have an undue amount of power here to change things. If Democrats can't get them on board, there is no way that this is going to pass the Senate. And, you know, it's going to be a tough, long fight with a lot of negotiation. I think that this is President Joe Biden's keystone issue, and he is going to keep pushing, even if that means that we see that $3.5 trillion number come down, which I think we should expect to. And again, this is the initial proposal, these tax rates. I think that there is room for maneuvering there.
The headline from Fortune.com, Democrats float largest tax increase in decades to fund Biden's $3.5 trillion budget, written by politics reporter Nicole Goodkind. Thank you very much for the information.
Thanks for having me.
Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today. We continue now on Capitol Hill with senators discussing the Voting Rights Act. This from TheHill.com. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is pushing Democrats to unify amid high-profile divisions that are threatening to bog down President Biden's $3.5 trillion spending plan. Here's Senator Schumer speaking to reporters earlier.
You said that you're bringing up this new voting rights bill as soon as next week, and you've also acknowledged that Republicans are not likely to support it. What is your game plan on voting rights as majority leader?
The first part of our game plan is to come up with a bill that all 50 Democrats can support. We have done that. The bill has been introduced today. It keeps the safeguards that we need, but makes some changes. We have, as you know, Senator Manchin, who believes that we should try to make this bipartisan. And we're giving him the opportunity to do that with a bill that he supports and that he modified. If that doesn't happen, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. As I've said, all options are on the table.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell also spoke to reporters on voting rights.
I said on voting rights yesterday, Martin Luther King III and Reverend Al Sharpton said they were seeking a meeting with you. They tried to deliver a letter to your office, and they say they were refused. Can you explain what happened, number one? And number two, do you think there is any appetite within your party for this revamped voting rights bill, the Freedom to Vote Act?
Let me say for the umpteenth time, going back to discussions about federalizing the way we handle elections after the 2016 election, that there is no rational basis for the federal government taking over how we conduct elections in this country. Secondly, the Voting Rights Act was not struck down by the Supreme Court. It's still in existence. That is one area where the federal government does say you cannot keep people from voting based upon race. Beyond that, this is not something the federal government has historically been involved in, for good reason. Every state conducts elections differently. You're watching some states pass new laws based upon the experience we had last year during a 100-year pandemic. What do all these new laws have in common? None of them, not one, is designed to suppress the vote based upon race. So there is no reason for the federal government to take over how we conduct elections. It is a solution in search of a problem, and we will not be supporting that.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Meanwhile, a second day on Capitol Hill for Secretary of State Antony Blinken. This time, he faced members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. USA Today reports Committee Chair New Jersey Democrat Bob Menendez, quote, blasted the Biden administration's handling of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan as fatally flawed and threatened to subpoena Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin if he doesn't agree to testify in the near future, end quote. Here's Senator Bob Menendez questioning Secretary Blinken.
Several commentators have suggested that had the department moved forward with the Crisis Contingency and Response Bureau proposed by the Trump administration as it was walking out the door, it would have been able to respond better to the Afghan situation. But it's my understanding that that bureau had not been stood up yet when you decided to curtail the proposal, nor as proposed did it actually add any additional resources or capabilities to those that state already had. It was a bureaucratic movement, not creating or getting rid of actual capabilities, just a new organizational chart. And in that bureaucratic reshuffling, potentially creating damage to the department's operations, not solving them. Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. If it's not the CCR, then what is the answer?
Well, here again, to your point, with regard to the CCR, whether it became a bureau or not, there was no change in the assets that we already had at hand to work on these efforts. The focus of this group, either in its existing organizational structure or had it become a bureau, which, among other things, it didn't because there were congressional holds across the aisle on this effort. The previous administration nonetheless went through and tried to move it forward. We decided that we needed to review it. We did the review, and as you described very accurately, we found that this would add no assets to what we already had at hand. It would simply create a different bureaucratic structure. But having said that, again, this is something designed primarily for individual extractions, medical emergencies. These men and women who are part of our operational medical unit are remarkable and do incredible work, but not the kind of work that would have been applicable to the large evacuation that we had to conduct.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken responding to questions from Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair, New Jersey Democrat Senator Bob Menendez, Idaho Republican Senator Jim Risch. Also questioned Secretary Blinken on the events surrounding the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Mr. Secretary, I can tell you, I've listened to you and a handful of other people try to put the best face on this possible, and I can tell you that the temperature of the American people is not there with you, and that I'm not talking from a partisan basis. This goes both ways. You know, there is not enough lipstick in the world to put on this pig to make it look any different than what it actually is. So we need the American people want to know who's responsible for this. So let's start with this. Who is responsible? Who made the decisions on this? Was it the President of the United States?
Ultimately, the President makes the decisions. That's correct.
Did he in this case?
As in every case, ultimately decisions that can only be decided by the President are decided by the President.
Well,
now, of course, to be specific, Senator, there are hundreds, thousands of decisions every single day that go into a situation as complex as this one. The big strategic decisions, those are decided by the President. The tactical, operational decisions are made by different agencies, agency heads, agency officials.
Well, I'm more interested in the top decision-making. Mm-hmm. Look, we've all seen this. We saw it as recently as yesterday. Somebody in the White House has authority to press the button and stop the president, cut off the president's speaking ability and sound. Who is that person?
I think anyone who knows the president, including members of this committee, knows that he speaks very clearly and very deliberately for himself. No one else does.
Well, are you saying that there is no one in the White House that can cut him off? Because yesterday that happened, and it's happened a number of times before that. It's been widely reported that somebody has the ability to push the button and cut off his sound and stop him from speaking. Who is that person?
There is no such person. Again, the president speaks for himself. Makes all of the strategic decisions informed by the best advice that he can get from the people around him.
So are you unaware that this is actually happening? Because it happened yesterday at the Interagency Fire Center. It was widely reported. The media's reported on it. And it's not the first time it's happened. It's happened several times. Are you telling this committee that this does not happen, that there's no one in the White House who pushes the button and cuts him off in mid-sentence?
That's correct.
That was Secretary Antony Blinken responding to questions from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee ranking member, Idaho Republican Senator Jim Risch. Thanks for joining us for Washington Today. A reminder that all of our coverage is online anytime at cspan.org. And if you missed any of this program, you can find it at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington, delivered daily right to your inbox, you can subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba. Thanks for listening today to Washington Today.